I'm John Yoder, and this is the last of a series of five. What was posted and announced was only the subtitles, so it isn't too clear what it's about. The general theme of the 5 hours has been the changing face of the moral problem of war. My task has been more to report the role of a historian or journalist than to argue, although in these last two sessions I'm also presenting new developments which I happen to support that do modify the way the discussion about the moral meaning of war goes on among morally concerned people, and now specifically in a Christian perspective. Obviously, the way the rotation of people goes on here, it can't be assumed that most of you were around for the other 3 and 4 sessions. The first 3 discussed the developments of many people, including some official teachings of the Roman Catholic Church, some official statements of the World Council of Churches, more recently a Methodist statement, applying more critically the old tradition according to which a war must be justified if it's to be morally acceptable. And we saw that that notion of restraint has been gaining ground in certain circles. This time, for the first time, I'll be talking about something more directly reaching back to the New Testament itself and to some standard basic Christian affirmations. Most of what I'll be saying this evening was in some old tapes. I was here in 78 and 81 and 83, but those tapes aren't in the lending library here anymore. And anyway, I'll say it differently. So I'm talking about developments in Christian thought, things that people say today, those who say them, different from what would have been the case 50 years ago in the same circles. The word incarnation has, down through the centuries, had two very different kinds of focus. Both had to do, obviously, with the affirmation that we have from the first century, especially in the language of the Gospel of John, that the Word became flesh, or that God became man. But you can think about that in two very different ways. In one direction, you can make of it a metaphysical, a philosophical puzzle. How can it be that the transcendent becomes limited, that the infinite becomes finite, and that preoccupation with the happening of something that by definition couldn't happen leads to discussions about the transformation of nature? What does it do to the world that God became human? And there's room for both intellectual and cultural developments that concentrate on the presence of the divine in something human, and often not just in the man Jesus then, but in other things like in the Eastern Orthodox Communion, the icon, or other ways in which the world, the natural world, the material world, is transformed. If that concern for incarnation has any impact on how people behave socially, on ethics or politics, it is conservative, because God's entering into human affairs as they are sanctifies them as they are. And that's the way it's usually been argued in those parts of the Christian tradition. But secondly, the other focus of the concentration on incarnation, which is present in the New Testament more simply and bluntly, is that when the first generations of Christians found themselves in the challenging position of explaining their faith in Jesus to people who didn't have a Jewish background, because their church was a missionary church, they started using language like this. to say what we have seen in Jesus is normative for the universe. What we have seen in Jesus comes from the divine nature. And that is said the most simply in John's Gospel, chapter 1, and in the second chapter of Paul's letter to the Philippians, talking about taking on the form of a servant and becoming as men are. And it's this understanding of the incarnation which is not posing a philosophical puzzle, but pointing to the humanity of Jesus as normative, which I indicate in reviewing Christian thought in the past 30 years is taking on a new meaning with reference to the problem of war and politics, as Christians ought to look at it. That is, when John's letter begins, something which has existed from the beginning, that we've heard, that we've seen with our own eyes, that we've watched and touched with our hands, the Word who is life, that life was made visible, we saw it, and we're giving our testimony. That's the statement for which incarnation is the code word. Well, John wasn't discussing the metaphysical impossibility of the finite becoming the infinite becoming finite. He was saying, what we're telling you about that we knew in Jesus, we first generation witnesses, is normative. It's valid. It's what counts in his humanness. Now, three decades ago, I started gathering the scholarship of New Testament researchers over a rather broad spectrum of questions and rephrasing them for ordinary people to read. Some people think ordinary people can read it, some think it still has too many footnotes. But I began the research process, which issued in printing 16 years ago, a book called The Politics of Jesus. At that time, it seemed odd to most people that I should describe Jesus as having been political, because of the assumptions that people brought to the use of that word and assumptions that people brought to the reading of the gospel story. Now that kind of statement is a platitude. Anywhere in New Testament studies, people would say, what else is new? Of course Jesus was political. That deep change in the way scholars read the Jesus story is not because they all read my book and it converted them all. It's rather because they read the same sources that I had found and faced the same facts that I had been dealing with 20 years ago, and actually learned that if you look at the gospel story without blinders or without the grid of some particular later understanding, it is about a man whose calling was to be a liberator. What has helped people to see that? Well, one, there certainly are things about the agenda of our time, the world's agenda, some people would say, that have pushed people to look for that and then to see it, as we are in an age when the demands of justice raised by the oppressed people of the world and others on their behalf can not simply be shunted aside as coming next or as sure to be dealt with somehow later if we get something else straight first that needs to be dealt with first. In the past 20 years, liberation has come to be one of the slogans giving direction to Christian theology, and meaning that we'll best understand the scriptures in general as having to do with what it means to be unfree humans and to be freed by God's coming among us. That's one of the elements of the change in the atmosphere. There are other elements of scholars simply being more honest with the facts and also having more facts. Archaeological studies, the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, more study in the details of the politics of the first century, have heightened the readiness of people to see that Jesus was some kind of a liberation leader. The angel told his mother to name him Yahweh liberates. That's the meaning of the name, Yehoshua, or Jesus. Then the question was, if Yahweh is going to liberate, how is he going to do it? That doesn't mean that in our day, when people say Christian message has to speak to the question of justice, they only got that idea from the New Testament. No, they also got it from Thomas Jefferson and Karl Marx and a bunch of other modern people. So the awareness has been sensitized, but it is not an alien question to take back to the New Testament. And when you go back to the New Testament with more tools, you find more. That is, there are social science tools now being used on both Old and New Testament sources. Sociologists are interpreting the ancient stories with a view to class and social stratification and migration patterns and economic production patterns, and finding much more that was there to throw light on actually how the Israelite movement came to be way back when, and what the various phases of it meant, including the place of the early Christians in the Roman Empire of their time. So Jesus was a social actor. He brought change into a situation where the bulk of his people were looking for change. They sensed that they were oppressed. The Roman presence was not only an alien political presence, that they did not have national sovereignty, which they hadn't had for centuries, but it was also spiritually an alien presence. That is, people that did not serve the true God were prospering, and people who served the true God were suffering. And that's an insult if you believe that the true God is also a God who is powerful to save. So there was a very precise awareness that this can't be the way it's supposed to be. God must have the intention of freeing us. Some of those people expressed that confidence in scenarios of liberation that were going to be done miraculously by angels coming down, and others in scenarios that were going to be done very pragmatically by their own angry young men going out into the desert and organizing the National Liberation Front. There were different ways that this was dealt with, but it was the agenda of the time. People weren't listening to Jesus with a view to being taught the right way to pray the Lord's Prayer, or the right way to purify themselves before they went into the temple. They were listening to Jesus as to how he was going to bring the freedom that would end the insult to God's dignity that was represented by the presence of the Romans in that country. Well, Jesus didn't answer that question according to the scenarios they had available. He wasn't a Che Guevara. He wasn't either a desert hermit going off into the desert of Judea to copy the scriptures and put them in jars for modern archaeologists to find. But he was answering those questions. It was that agenda that he accepted. And therefore, when we ask, what does the New Testament say to the moral evaluation of war as a way of serving God's purposes and serving valid purposes of human justice, we can no longer say as easily as most people said 2 centuries ago, what Jesus says is not on the subject. Because he came for something else. He came to be put to death so that our sins would be forgiven, and that has nothing to do with freedom. That was the old answer in Catholic and Lutheran forms in different ways, and Pietist forms. Jesus simply was not a political reality. And therefore, how he happened to get himself killed was not really pertinent to the fact that the reason there needed to be the death of this perfect man was related to the salvation of our souls for eternity, and not to the way to be God's righteous person within a situation of oppression. Now we can't use that escape. We have to take Jesus straight as a model, and that means also his teaching, like the kind of thing he said in the Sermon on the Mount, instead of being idealism, is actually a description of the way he was going to act, and what he was going to do and what he did. So there's a unity between his teaching, for instance, the Sermon on the Mount, with its focus on the law being fulfilled, and not only loving friends, but loving even enemies, and not only not killing, but not even hating. There is a fit between that statement of the new way to live a life that fulfills the law and glorifies our Father who is in heaven, and the way Jesus was actually going to go about being a social leader, creating a community that would resist the injustice of the time, but resist it nonviolently. That doesn't mean that I would be uninterested if this were a systematic theology study, or a study of the history of the dogmas of the church in the ancient centuries, in discussing that other set of problems, that is, incarnation as a philosophical puzzle or a philosophical impossibility, that the divine became human, and the implications of that for developing the doctrine of the Trinity, or developing the doctrine of the two natures of Christ, and all of the things that did get worked out in formula of the theologians in the 4th and 5th and 6th centuries. But that isn't what the New Testament is most accentuating when it makes the statements that it makes that focus on the uniqueness of Jesus. We've been trained not to see ethics in those statements. We're trained to recognize ethics if we find somebody saying, "What should you do if?" question mark. Or, "Would it be wrong under these circumstances to do this?" question mark. But when we read in Isaiah that the suffering servant was cut off from the land of the living, or what it means when we read in Hebrews, he learned obedience through the things that he suffered, or when we read in Philippians that the second Adam, unlike the first, did not consider kingship a thing to grasp, but became a servant and received a rebel's penalty, or what it means when we're told in Colossians that Jesus, by taking the way of the cross, disarmed the principalities and powers. Those things are always talking about the man Jesus deciding whether or not to use violence. The man Jesus deciding whether he's going to be a rebel leader, living up to the scenario of the people who were later called zealots, the people of zeal, who were the National Liberation Front of the time. We know that numerous of his disciples came from that crowd, that expectation was around them all the time. It shows as a temptation in the desert and in the garden, the beginning and the end of his recorded ministry. Jesus was tempted by the option of violence in the name of justice. It's when he rejected that temptation that he made the decision that is the most fundamental to how he was going to be different from the first Adam, if you're reading Philippians 2, or how he was going to be the initiator of a better covenant, if you use the language of Hebrews. That was the difference that Jesus made. It was on the subject of the very normal, legitimate, widespread human demand for God to use violence on our side against our enemies. So you don't start with the gospel and then need to build a bridge to get to politics. You start with politics, with whether God's liberating envoy into society is going to be a zealot leader, a Fidel Castro, or is going to accept death at the hand of his enemies. That's the first meaning of incarnation. It's when the earliest witnesses say, "In Jesus we saw God at work." It's that about Jesus that they're talking about. It isn't just that he taught moral truths, like in the Sermon on the Mount or the parables. And it isn't just that looking at his death after the fact, his death and resurrection after the fact, people saw that also as a sacrifice after the model of the priestly ritual of ancient Israel, which reconciles sinners to the God they have sinned against. That was there, but that was a further meaning that was read into the event. The first thing we mean when we say incarnation, if we say it with the New Testament writers, is that this man Jesus, in how he chose to be a liberator, reveals the purpose and the nature of God. His Jesus' setting was that of a national liberation struggle. His agenda was that of justice and the dignity of God's people. We can't read the Gospels anymore by distinguishing religion from politics or souls from lifestyles, because it's all on one subject. He had other choices. He could have been part of the establishment that collaborated with the Romans. We read about the Sadducees and the Herodians. These were people who made the best of a bad deal. They knew the Romans were never going to be defeated, and they knew that they would better serve their own people if they didn't resist all the time. So they negotiated with the Romans, and they did pretty well. They got the Romans to promise not to bring their idolatrous military standards into Jerusalem when their troops came up from Caesarea. They got the permission to have their own coinage so that they wouldn't bring idolatrous coins into the temple to pay the tax. In various other ways, they had a degree of recognition by the Romans of the religious independence of the Jewish people. So it was a better deal than most subject peoples got from the Romans. And Jesus didn't take that path. There were the monastic communities out in the desert. Jesus probably had some relation to their tradition through John the Baptist, but he moved to the city. He didn't stay in the desert. There were the so-called Pharisees, in a broader sociological sense. He was a part of the Pharisaic movement, but what most characterized them was their distinguishing between the places where you may go ahead with the wider society, pursue your trade and make your money, and the places where you had to keep yourself clean. The word Pharisee means separate, by certain rituals of not carrying Roman coinage on your person, etc. And that kind of fine distinctions Jesus didn't accept. He was actually closer to the Zealots, that is the National Liberation Front, the people who believed that God would help them to fight a violent battle against the Romans with the help of angels. That appears to have been a real temptation for him. He turned it down, and that made him who he was. That defined who he was as the suffering servant, or as the man of God among us. So the first new shade of meaning that the notion of incarnation takes on in the argument about the moral vision that we have of violence in society is a more direct look at Jesus as relating to that. Rather than simply Jesus as a rabbi giving us some truth about love of enemy, or Jesus as the sacrificial figure dealing with the forgiveness of our sins and then leaving us to some other resources for figuring out what to do in society. If we affirm that the humanness of Jesus is the presence of God among his people in their oppression, then what Jesus did about that oppression, namely leading a movement of resistance that got him crucified, has a normative value for us, and it certainly does if you read the rest of the New Testament. There's a second dimension of what the code word incarnation means that I'll point to much more briefly because I talked about it yesterday, and that's because it throws new light on a very current debate, a very standard logical debate. It isn't only the academic philosophers but also the Cracker Barrel philosophers who very easily distinguish between realism and idealism. Idealism is when you have strong commitments to something and you may think you got them from some kind of revelation, some kind of high moral authority, And realism is when you do what you have to do to get done what you have to get done. That's on the level of concepts. We saw yesterday at some length in looking at the teaching of Martin Luther King and Mohandas Gandhi, only as important modern figures, not as at all unique, that distinction is itself a denial that you can do the will of God in this world. The idea that you may have ideal ends, but you must, by realistic choice of means, betray those ends for the sake of those ends, is not a realistic, practical statement. It's a philosophical commitment against incarnation. It means the prior logical decision that the guidelines that we're given, whether if we're Christians, we think we get them in Jesus. If we were Muslims, we think we got them somewhere else. But the decision to say that those ideals cannot be realized in human life. But if we affirm the incarnation, we do affirm that they were realized in human life. That's the meaning of the statement that we make about Jesus, and by implication about anybody that is a part of that same body or that same story. The second thing looks almost like a different chapter, but it is, in a deep sense, the other side of the same coin. Both Martin Luther King and Gandhi taught the world a lot of lessons by finding practical things to do. That is, tactics and techniques of non-cooperation, of non-violent resistance, of direct action provoking the resistance of the unjust structures of society in such a way that there would first of all be some suffering for those who provoked it, but in the long run there would be movement. There are ways to do things that fit with the ideals, that are realistic. So again, the split between realism and idealism is not only overcome in the kind of popularizers, preachers kind of philosophy that we have in Gandhi and King, but it was also overcome in the strategist, social leader's role that both of those men filled, by actually organizing people to change the shape of the world by making their commitment against violence a positive rather than a negative force in society. It wasn't just saying, I won't do violence, but our commitment to affirm the dignity of the adversary whom we will not violate is an affirmative statement about the human community. And it's an affirmative commitment to including the adversary in the good cause. If you start using the language that people call realistic, you always have to say, well, sorry, I have a good cause, but the adversary isn't part of it, because in order to get it, I have to run over him first. So nonviolence is first a definition of the human community. It means that the enemy is included. And the tactics we choose together to use, they're feasible tactics, and yet they are compatible with the idea that leads us. That's an updating of my slogan, incarnation. We don't agree that idealism is unrealistic. We don't agree that the ends cannot dictate the means. Obviously, you see that under this set of slogans, more than one real meaning is included, but that's intentional because they are general slogans which apply in that kind of way. The second general term in my title, and I encourage you to be dubious about whether any of this makes sense or whether it's adequately argued, but it probably is better to make the second point as well, and then we can have discussion over the whole scale. Second word in my title was hope. And what do we mean by that? Well, I've already started talking about it when, quoting Gandhi and King, I said that they said that the split between ends and means will not stand up because the means are the ends in the process of becoming. And you can't use evil means and come on a good end. Why? Well, because there's something about the universe that is coherent. The universe is somehow tilted toward justice, even if only in the long run. King said that because he was partly a Black Baptist with their version of the Christian hope, and partly he was a liberal American Protestant by virtue of his education with their vision of the Christian hope, and partly he was an American loyalist with the belief in the wisdom of the Founding Fathers and the Bill of Rights. But in all of those ways together, King was just sure that in the long run and on the average, good means will lead to good ends and bad means will torpedo good ends. And Gandhi said the same thing in a different frame of reference, because as a Hindu he believed in a different way of putting the universe together, but it's also a way in which no evil deed is ever lost. It'll keep on producing evil effects down through the chain, the great chain of being, and no good deed is ever lost. So ultimately the good will win, even not if not in this generation. So both of these men had a moral, religious cosmology, that is a doctrine of how things hang together in the universe, and what is afoot in the universe, to use the Holden slogan for this year, is that love is gradually gaining ground, even if it doesn't show at the time. Well, that's a statement of hope. Things that scholars are paying more attention to in the New Testament than they did for quite a while is the kind of literature in the New Testament that talks about unveiling or revelations, or to use the Greek term, apocalypse. Apocalypse means unveiling or revelation. It's the Greek name for the book of Revelation at the end of the New Testament, but it's also the name of a kind of literature that we have some other places, some places in the Gospels and little snatches in the epistles. That is, times when the early Christians looked forward to a picture of a world in which God would be victorious. That particular subset of the texts in the New Testament were kind of embarrassing to Christian scholars for quite a while, except on the far right, where fundamentalists read them as kind of a train schedule for the things that have to happen in the last few decades of the universe, and thought that there were very simple ways to do that and to correlate it with the facts of secular history. That's the system that Ronald Reagan still believes in, according to which he knows where the Battle of Armageddon will take place sometime. That the simplicity and the crudeness of that kind of reading put a lot of other people, turned a lot of other people off, and they just said, well, we can do without those texts, since we don't know what they mean anyway. There is a new wave of serious scholarly search going into reading those texts for what they must have meant at the time. They certainly meant something. They certainly weren't written in the first century of the Christian era, or the early second, or the Old Testament equivalent. They're certainly not written back when they were written with a view to informing us specifically about something that happened in the year 1986 or whenever. But they were written with some meaning, and we can find that meaning. We can find that meaning if we immerse ourselves better in the culture of the time, if we read better the parallel literature of the time, if we understand better who would have written this kind of material. For a long time, ordinary Protestants assumed we know clearly what these texts mean, and they're wrong because the world didn't end that way. So we just concede the text to the fundamentalists. And now, ever since Albert Schweitzer, the beginning of this century, Ernst Käsemann as a major German interpreter in the middle of the century, there is much growing seriousness in trying to read these texts for what they basically do say. And what helps them become clear is the reminder that any kind of a text, any kind of literature, makes sense in a particular social setting. Well, what is the social setting in which you would see visions, or you would write poetry, or you would project dramatic scenarios about how God is going to win in the end? Well, it would be if you were being oppressed. apocalyptic literature is the literature of underdogs who keep saying, even though there is no objective scientific way to link it with other current events, that God has to win in the end. And since we don't see God winning, you can only describe it in unreal terms of visions and angelic figures and events in the stars and strange creatures. You can only describe God's victory in terms that aren't real, because God isn't really victorious yet, but you know God has to be victorious, so you say it anyway. And that's apocalyptic literature. And Paul Hansen, who's been one of the guests here, is one of the people helping in the last generation to be more serious that way about the apocalyptic literature of the Old Testament, and it's happening as well with the New. And is a renewed commitment to let those texts, although they are not to be taken literally, whatever that would mean, speak to us of the conviction of people who are underdogs that their God is still going to win in the end. And one of the reasons we have trouble with understanding that kind of literature is, of course, that we are mechanically and scientifically minded and not poetically inclined and not good at empathizing with other people's visions, but it's also partly that we're not underdogs. We know that if you want to make a good cause triumph, you organize a party, or you get into the party, and you get a party platform passed, and then you get your candidate elected. Our image of how good causes succeed is from the top. And we have, in the broader sense, since Constantine, 1500 years, and in the shorter sense, since George Washington, 200 years, of relative success in the good guys making things happen from the top. So we don't need apocalypse. We don't need visions and scenarios of angels and strange creatures coming up out of the pit to reassure us that God will win in the end, because we've been winning already. We've been on the winning side of most battles. And so we don't deeply empathize with the underdogs of a subject society. So again, it's the sociologists that help us see more clearly the mind in which God's victory is certain, not because God's people are in a position of power, not because God's people have a game plan or a party platform which will get elected, if not this time, 4 years from now, but rather because of the conviction that in the coming and the death and the rising and the ascension of Jesus, we know how the world has to come out. So we keep affirming that, or the Christians of the book of the Apocalypse of John kept affirming that in a situation where there was no possible way to see that or to say it, but they said it anyway. And we can, once we know that that's what that literature is about, join them in that kind of a song. So it's a vision of history under God, but the certainty that God's cause will be victorious is linked with his people being faithful in their suffering, but not with their taking power. When Martin Luther King said in front of the Lincoln Memorial, "I have a dream," and his variations on "From Every Mountainside Let Freedom Ring," it wasn't true because he happened to have the Kennedys on his side, and then Johnson. It wasn't true because the American dream is itself self-validating and is gaining ground. It isn't to be verified because we can measure our ability to project and then to manipulate a causal sequence which will lead us from where we are to where we want to be. But it was true if it was true. It is true as he said it, insofar as it correlates with or resonates with what God has already been doing in Jesus. So what is afoot in the universe is not something that started the day before yesterday or that we just noted in the 20th century. It's something that began with Abraham or maybe with Noah, but whose turning point in Jesus validates our continuing to say that that's where the world has to go. Not because we can get a futurologist to extrapolate from our growth rates to where we're going to come out in two more generations, but because of the resurrection. So if we look back to be realistic about how you can serve justice, how you can promote the peace of the world, or how you can prevent the destruction of the world, there too our appeal is not to the relative rationality of the next generation of people that might show up in the Pentagon to negotiate with some less pushy people in the Kremlin, but it's the conviction that whether it looks that way or not, the world's going to go the way Jesus went. Up to you to test or respond or lash back at any point.
The way Jesus went was death, right? So you're saying,
well, nonviolent servanthood at the cost of the risk of death. He didn't die right away, and not all his disciples died, but they were ready to. But love of enemy, say it positively. The commitment that the justice that God wants for everybody includes the enemy, rather than destroying the enemy for the sake of the rest of us. That was the primary operational innovation of Jesus as over against the generations that were waiting for him. It wasn't brand new, it's in Proverbs too. But to make it that central is new in Jesus and in the Sermon on the Mount, in his own verbal explanation of himself. And that's the way the universe has got to go.
The only person that I've met that really knows this and knows it to the core of their being is a friend of mine who lives in Spokane, Washington. And she is a Salvadoran refugee who is in sanctuary in a Roman Catholic church there. And she truly believes this because she has really suffered. Her husband was murdered and she witnessed that, and then she was raped. And yet she can say that she has hope and that she forgives the people who did this to her, and she truly forgives it. And she is able to offer me so much hope. But I have a great deal of difficulty understanding that.
Now, we have been educated for 1,500 years with a power model. It is the good guy's got to win.
Mm-hmm.
Soon enough that I'll be in on it. Or if I make a sacrifice for the sake of the victory, I've got to be able to see the victory through my sacrifice.
Yeah.
It's only the underdogs of the world that can affirm the faith without seeing how their sacrifice is going to bring the victory.
How can you relate what you have just said to the recent occurrences in the Philippines where it was, you know, pretty much nonviolent, and South Africa, which seems to be going very much the violent direction, although there has been a nonviolent movement there?
Well, anything that I can say has to be very thin and modest. I don't think that there are any surprises from those experiences. The Manila event 2 years ago in February surprised a lot of people by demonstrating part of the truth of what I was saying about Gandhi and King. If you commit yourself to non-harming people, that's the Hindu word, ahimsa, non-harming, that commitment itself gives you a different kind of moral power. And on short notice, that power could be mobilized in the streets of Manila, and it could keep the two armies away from each other. It was still a confrontation of armies. But what kept the armies from clobbering each other was the civilians in the street between them. And they were there because the bishops asked them to come. And the bishops had the nerve to ask them to come because there had been some nonviolence training going on in their country in the previous year. So that there's a strong case that one particular political event could turn a country around thanks to the commitment to nonviolence on the part of strategic people. That didn't, however, mean that the Philippines have solved their problem, because all they got was a new government. And one of the mistakes of revolutionary ideology around the world on all sides is that if you got in the government, then you could fix things. And you can't. So Cory Aquino got in the government, and now you still can't fix it. She still has to politic with the generals, and she still hasn't found a way to reach an understanding with the rebels. So it turned out that victory has not been exploited maximally for the potential there might have been of a new running start. Now, in the South African scene and the present West Bank developments under Israel, there I think we're seeing in both places an escalation of tension, but in a situation where the use of armed violence on the part of the underdogs would be still worse for everybody. Obviously, if we were black Africans, we would have lost patience 20 years ago. But that wouldn't mean that if we got the guns, we could do anything with them, because the other people still have more guns and airplanes. So although the rational case for possible humane solutions is getting worse and worse and worse, that doesn't mean there's a rational case for violence. And that's why Alan Busack and Tutu and a large part of the leadership of the South African Christian Council are still saying, against their own denominational tradition and against the government and against the anger of the younger generation, violence will never be a way through this. In the case of the West Bank, certainly the Israelis would have crushed the resistance much more strongly if they'd been using something other than guns. I mean, if they'd been using guns, something other than stones. I think it's too bad they used stones. And the Israelis were stupid to expel from the country a man who was trying to make the movement more nonviolent. But still, if you have a spectrum from maximum violence to nonviolence, throwing stones is pretty far on the nonviolent end of the spectrum, especially if it's kids who come out in the street to throw stones at tanks. So in both of these cases, we still see a strong prima facie case that authentic nonviolence is more likely to provide a breakthrough than escalating of anything to do with weapons. It doesn't provide a way through soon, and not one without bloodshed. But in both those places, there would be less bloodshed if it could continue without weapons on the part of the underdog than if all of a sudden, for instance, the Arab League were to start bringing machine guns into the West Bank, and then the whole place would simply be flattened.
I'm still a little unclear on maybe exactly what you're advocating. I appreciate what you're saying, and I've heard you say sort of advocate Christ's example of sort of passively suffering to act in an unseen way as an example that we're to follow. And yet, at the same time, you're saying the reason for following that is not that we could hope to necessarily see something in our lifetime that, like you're mentioning, you know, we're willing to invest if we'll be around to see the changes. But then you also say that Christ's example as a suffering servant is that he didn't see a change. I guess I'm not seeing. It doesn't bother me, but I don't see a great. I'm not sure where you come down if you're advocating that Christ-like passive power, sort of spiritual moral power, has a validity in itself, and that God, in the end, will bring it about despite what we do or don't we do, don't do. I guess I'm not sure what the difference is between what you're advocating and, say, what pietist you would contrapose yourself against a pietist. What the pietist would say, in that what they're saying is that it's the point of pressure is the spiritual point, that we can't hope to make broad, you know, social changes in this point in time, that the difference, in fact, between power and suffering is whether or not the person suffering is a Christian or doing it for a Christ-like purpose, or whether they're just a victim of suffering.
Well, let me start by picking up the particular vocabulary you used. The word passive means suffering, and in that sense, I guess, that does describe what Jesus did. But I'd rather call it active, because Jesus initiated the processes which brought him to his death. He didn't just sit there and wait for him to happen. He led a movement that bothered the authorities so much that they decided at their own schedule to get rid of him, even though it was over a feast weekend. So that he was an initiator. He wasn't passive in that sense. He was passive in the accepting suffering. But the way in which the victory came wasn't that he just didn't think about that and would let God figure that out later, but that he initiated a movement which proclaimed the dignity of the underdog, which set up a common kitchen for poor and rich together, which had men and women and slave and free in the same social group. That is, he started a new social movement which was against the current of the structures of the time, whether people liked it or not. And he made that movement viable, despite the fact that he was killed off and some of its other leaders were soon killed off. So he started a different history. He didn't just let an idea loose in the world. What a pietist would say would be different in numerous places. One difference is that the pietist says the difference is only inside the heart. That is, I become a believer and then I'll feel different, and you become a believer and you'll feel different, and she'll become a believer and she'll feel different, and all these differences will somehow imperceptibly change the atmosphere of the world. Jesus did it the other way around. He changed the way people behave together. Now, you're not going to change the way you behave together unless something about your insides comes with it, and you internalize the new attitude towards hope and the enemy and the material world, etc. But it didn't start from the inside, either mentally or psychically. It started from joining the movement of the people who say that God's reign is now effective. So it isn't focused on the individual as the funnel through which the newness comes. And the other thing, historically, is that most people who themselves would be characterized or would be characterized by others as pietists have been nationalists. They have trusted the political authorities of their own government. And they've said that if the world is going to change, well, then let's get pious people in our government, and they'll use our good government power for good. So they weren't fundamentally critical of the structures of society, but they were rather trying to enlighten a little the mentality of the rulers or the factory owners, etc., so that the powerful people will be more generous. Whereas the Jesus movement starts with the Song of Mary, according to which the powerful people are going to get off their stools and the poor are going to take over. So it's a picture of a different story.
I have a question. I was just kind of interested, if you see Revelation as being something inspired merely by an oppressive period in time rather than a divinely inspired prophecy, how do you see Revelation is functioning in our lives as Christians today?
Well, the first half of your question, did you mean the book entitled Revelation or the event?
Well, I'm referring to the book entitled Revelation as well as elements of Revelation within the Gospel.
No, I would say that whether we're talking about a certain kind of event whereby God's purposes are known to people, or whether we're talking about those texts, that I see them not as the product of a setting, but as communicated into a setting and therefore having the shape of that setting. But they're not the product of that setting, they're a product of God the Spirit speaking through people. The difference being that when God speaks through people now, we're no longer in the first apostolic generation, it no longer will get into the canon of the New Testament, but it can still be the same God saying the same things. And if they're really the same, if it's really the same God saying the same things, they will rhyme. They will be in coherence with what was said before, and that's why we study what was said before, in order to recognize in our own world when the revelations are congruent. So I'm affirming in both the present and the canonical period that God is really speaking, communicating, but really that means in the language and the setting of the people of the time. And we have to get ourselves into their skin to know what it means. And if we say, I want to know, the way many American fundamentalists have, I want to know from the book of Revelation who the man is whose name is 666. And I want to know from the book of Ezekiel when the battle of Armageddon is going to be. But meanwhile, I don't want that to shake my posture in the world as part of the American domination of the globe. That's an incoherent way to ask that question. Because Ezekiel was talking to underdogs, and the book of the Apocalypse was talking to underdogs, making sense of their suffering status.
So how would you see us as interpreting it today, since we are not underdogs?
Well, we can train ourselves to empathize with underdogs. We can read the Salvadoran story and the South African story and the Chilean story, and do the kind of intellectual training that enables people to put themselves in the skin of other people in other settings, so as to recreate in our own posture something like, it would never be identical, but something like the kinds of needs and petitions and sense of injustice and calls on God for justice that mark that time. We have room for one more comment at most.
From what you said, would it be inconsistent for a Christian to, taking the position that you have articulated, to advocate there to be an army in the nation of which one was a part?
I think it would be pointless to advocate an army since we have one. There might be circumstances in which I would say, as an observer of the total social scene, that there are some functions which organize political power discharges which the sober, limited, disciplined, restrained use of those kinds of power can still be used for, that are not lethal and that are not unjust. Could be. We could, for instance, use an army to keep the Turks and the Greeks from eating each other in Cyprus, patrolling peacetime frontiers. There are roles for which military organization is good. But I would see no grounds on which to argue with a society that it needs more armies than it has. And in most settings, my calling is, if you think you need an army, then look at the just war tradition and limit what you're ready to have your army do to what your tradition says it should be doing. But that's talking the language of the other tradition.
I guess I was asking, is the just war tradition even consistent with what you have been articulating?
It's not consistent with it, but it's the language I use when I'm going the third mile to talk the language of people who claim to be morally accountable in their terms. Thank you.
Thank you.